In human beings, we have a unique situation. We have consciousness is coupled to intelligence. The machines are not conscious. And in fact, the leaders in the AI world are not trying to make a conscious machine. Peter Norvig and his colleagues, who write what's often regarded as the Bible on AI, said we wouldn't even know what it meant to try to have a conscious machine. The reason for that is that we do not know from a scientific perspective what consciousness is.
Right.
So the idea that we're going to build one is right. Nonsense. We've got five senses that make life meaningful. No machine has any of those senses because those senses depend crucially on being attached to consciousness. And the idea that if you just multiply the complexity, say, of a system, that consciousness, and here's the word that gets used all the time, will just emerge. It seems to be nonsense, not simply from a gut feeling point of view, but actually from a scientific point of view.
Welcome to Socrates in the City, Oxford edition. It is my great joy and honor this morning to have as my guest, as our guest, Dr. John Lennox. Many of you already know of him, but in case you don't, I will tell you, John Lennox is Emeritus Professor of Mathematics at Oxford University and a leading voice in the interface of science, philosophy, and religion. He's written many books. I recommend them, but today we'll be discussing his book 2084, and the AI Revolution, How Artificial Intelligence Informs Our Future. John Lennox, my friend, welcome.
Thank you very much.
It's whenever anyone brings up the subject of AI, I have at least two reactions. I find the whole thing mystifying and to some extent genuinely frightening. So I'm glad you've taken on the subject. What is the first thing you'd want to say about this thing we call artificial intelligence?
Well, it can be mystifying, and it is genuinely frightening, aspects of it. I think the important thing to realize is that we're speaking of two distinct things. First of all, is the AI that is in normal use, which we call narrow AI. And a narrow AI system does one and only one thing that normally requires human intelligence. That is why it's called artificially intelligent. It's not really intelligent. In human beings, God has coupled intelligence with consciousness. And it's very important at the beginning to realize this is computing machinery. It doesn't think. It has none of the five senses that we humans have and that make life meaningful. And we can go into that in detail. So the idea is that we have a computer, a large database. Let's say it contains 1 million x-rays of people's lungs with their labeled diseases. And then we take an x-ray of my lungs, the system compares my x-ray picture with the 1 million, and it produces in a few seconds and says, you probably have this disease. And nowadays, that kind of thing will be more accurate than you get at your local hospital. Now, that's a very positive use of narrow AI. And virtually all of the AI systems working at the moment are just narrow AI. They do one thing. They give you recommendations on Amazon or Google, or they do diagnostics, or they operate CCTVs and surveillance. So that's number one. Number two is the fact that, let me put it this way, AI is like a sharp knife. You can use a sharp knife for surgery, or you can use it for murder. And so the more we go on in this, the more there are huge ethical dimensions. Simple illustration. Recognition of faces is very useful for a police force in New York picking out criminals in a football crowd, for example. But the very same technology is being used in other parts of the world, like China, to suppress a minority of Uyghurs and really suppress them. So that you see, as the technology grows, you get good actors using it for good stuff and bad actors using it for bad stuff. So that's one aspect of it. The second kind of AI is what we call artificial general intelligence, AGI. That is the striving for a superintelligence. And there are two avenues people are going down. Number one is enhancing existing human intelligence with add-ons, building mechanical stuff into us, turning us into cyborgs. And many leading thinkers, not just sci-fi merchants, but scientists like Lord Rees, our former astronomer royal, who's a genius, he thinks the future will be held by the machines, that we'll eventually become absorbed into machines. And that is held seriously by thinkers today, including, by the way, the CEO of the biggest company in the world in Japan. His name is Masayoshi Son, and he's the SoftBank CEO. And he thinks the future is going to be in machines. The human will fade, and the machines will take
over.
What
does that mean? It sounds so abstract and confusing. How can the human fade in the machine? What does that mean?
Nobody knows what it means. You see, this is where it merges into science fiction, I believe. But just to get the general picture, people are trying to enhance humans. Now, when I put these on, I'm an enhanced human, and so are you. And I might have ear implants and things like that. And they think that they can do something pretty spectacular as time goes on. The other attitude is, look, our problem as human beings is we're built of biological material. We age, we fall to bits, and we die. So we need to either solve what's now called the technological problem of dying. This is Harari's view, and we'll solve that. That's just a technological problem. Or we start from scratch and build something like a substrate out of silicon, which won't perish biologically, and then find some mechanism of uploading our brains onto this silicon substrate and therefore living forever.
Well, you say find some mechanism to upload our brains, which you know, and I know, is nonsense.
Oh, yes. But
people pretend it's not nonsense. we have to, I mean, I think we have to draw a line and explain.
Oh, I draw a very strong line.
Well, draw it.
Yes, what I say when people come and tell me this is the transhumanist agenda.
Yeah.
And it's what I call the fictional side of AI. And they come to me and said, look, we got this marvelous idea. We're going to solve the problem of physical death, and we're going to upload humans and increase human happiness.
Yeah.
And I just look at them with a solemn face and I say, you're too late. And they say, what do you mean we're too late? We haven't got there yet. Oh, I said, you're far too late. First of all, the problem of physical death was solved 20 centuries ago when God raised Christ from the dead. And they look at me as if they've seen some kind of phenomenon. As a scientist, yes, I believe that God raised Jesus from the dead. And I said, as for uploading, I'm looking for the biggest uploading in history, because you see, God has promised that those who trust Christ, actually, he will raise them from the dead. And that's the biggest uploading there's ever going to be. And I said, it's got a lot more evidence going for it than your kind. So I found actually, and seriously, that can be a way in, because they understand it. They may not agree with me, but they understand what I'm saying. So it enables me to go to a part of Christianity that sometimes people are a bit scared to go to.
Including Christians.
Yes, I fear so.
Yeah. Well, that's part of where you go in your your book. I don't know that I want to leap there immediately.
Okay.
But I want to talk about the Turing test and the idea. I think many people are confused about the basics, some of the basics. For example, I think that there are many people who are under the misimpression that our brains are the same as our minds.
Yes.
For one thing, and then related, are confused about what consciousness is. In other words, they think that at some point, and of course, many otherwise brilliant people have this ridiculous idea that at some point, intelligence rises to suddenly leap into consciousness.
Yes.
And I don't know where they get that idea, but can we talk about that a minute and draw a line? Because many people are very confused about this, don't understand what consciousness is, and just assume that, I don't know whether it's IQ or megabytes, at some point it leaps. We leap from just computing into consciousness.
Part of the confusion comes from the use of a language that's ambiguous. You see, when we use words like deep learning or artificial intelligence or machine learning, people immediately anthropomorphize it and think it's like our human learning. So there are certain basic things we need to face. First of all, as I said a moment ago, in human beings, we have a unique situation. We have consciousness is coupled to intelligence. The machines are not conscious. And in fact, the leaders in the AI world are not trying to make a conscious machine. Peter Norvig and his colleagues, who write what's often regarded as the Bible on AI, said we wouldn't even know what it meant to try to have a conscious machine. The reason for that is that we do not know from a scientific perspective what consciousness is.
Right.
So the idea that we're going to build one is nonsense. We do not know what it is. But what we do know is, in humans, we can experience what we call qualia. That is the redness of red. We know what that experience is. And we've got five senses that make life meaningful. AI, no machine, no algorithmic system has any of those senses because those senses depend crucially on being attached to consciousness. And the idea that if you just multiply the complexity, say, of a system, that consciousness, and here's the word that gets used all the time, will just emerge.
Emerge.
Emergence is covers a multiple of sins, actually, is... It seems to be nonsense, not simply from a gut feeling point of view, but actually from a scientific point of view. One of the most brilliant mathematicians alive lives just a few hundred yards from here and has won the Nobel Prize. And his view is that the human mind, particularly in mathematics, can do things that are non-algorithmic. Now, if he's right, and I think he is, Sir Roger Penrose is his name, then you're never going to get a machine reproducing consciousness because human consciousness is not algorithmic.
So just to clarify, when you say algorithmic, because these words are thrown around, and most of us, everyone in the room but you here, is not a mathematician. So the words are thrown around, algorithm, whatever, and I think most of us who are not mathematicians really don't know what those words even mean.
Well, that's why I wrote that book, because that book is designed to give an introduction that doesn't assume that you know. An algorithm is just a set of step-by-step instructions to do something. It's as simple as that, codified in mathematics and in computer language. But that's what I tried to do in that, because the language is confusing. It's very confusing.
But for some people, they're being deliberately confusing.
Oh.
When you said emerge, that's a classic case of people. They use a word and it's a little bit sleight of hand.
Oh, it's completely sleight of hand. It's like life emergence. And I say to them, emerges in what way? just on its own, or does it need a catalyst, or does it need extra information? Or they squeeze out those questions. And so the origin of life becomes, well, it's bound to happen, you see. And it, unfortunately, is the same with AI.
It's exactly the same. It's exactly, I mean, because I've noticed it, you know, having interviewed James Tour, and when you talk to people about this, they're never clear and specific about how that happens. They just assume it in the same way that they would assume that at some point suddenly consciousness emerges.
And the reason for that sleight of hand is quite clear, because they look at the world and they see that something has happened. So they think that any old explanation, it must have emerged somehow. And they leave it at that. And that's obfuscation. It's just making nonsense out of the whole thing and insulting people's intelligence at the same time.
Well, part of what they're doing there, I guess, with the sleight of hand, is they're assuming materialism. They're assuming that it emerged in some kind of materialistic way.
That's the key to it, actually. It's the unspoken assumption that the solution must be materialistic and naturalistic. And there are relatively few people who are on, let's say, the atheist side, who've got the honesty of one of your famous New York philosophers, Thomas Nagel, who see that there's a great problem there. They, on the big scale, and it counts for me a lot, I got it originally from Lewis, and that is that the naturalistic worldview, the materialistic worldview, doesn't only shoot itself in the foot, it shoots itself in the brain, because it gives no account of the rationality that's needed to do any science or to produce any thought. Because it tells me, and I've faced up many top-class scientists with this, where they tell me that they say, well, I say, what do you do your science with? They say, well, they're about to say mind when they realize it's not politically correct to say mind, so they say brain. I believe it's mind, and they're not the same. I say, okay, brain, give me the short story of the brain. Well, the brain is the end product of a mindless, unguided process. And I look at them and smile, and they say, and you trust it? I said, tell me honestly. They've done this with many people. If you knew that the apparatus you use in your laboratory was the end product of a mindless, unguided process, would you trust it? Never. They've all said no. Mm. And I just say, you've got a problem, haven't you? Mm. The materialistic explanation is a non-explanation. It doesn't only shoot itself in the foot, Eric. That's painful. It shoots itself in the brain, and that's fatal.
Okay. Well, so part of what we talk about, the sleight of hand, and I mentioned Alan Turing. To me, part of the danger with AI is that most people who are not scientists or mathematicians are thinking about this on a deeper level, who haven't read your book, they're not aware of the idea that AI can give the impression of being a person, of having a personality, of having consciousness, but we know that it doesn't.
Alan Turing called it the imitation game. In other words, an AI system imitates, simulates human intelligence, yeah, in that it does something that normally requires human intelligence, but it's not itself intelligent, nor is it conscious. That's the thing you have to hold on to very strongly. In fact, one of the pioneers in AI was an American with a wonderful name, and Mellichamp. I met him. He's still around. And he wrote a paper years ago with this lovely title, "The Artificial in Artificial Intelligence is Real." In other words, the word artificial in the phrase artificial intelligence is real. And he said, if we only realized that, we'd not make all of these mistakes. But there's a huge drive.
Yeah.
And it's a materialistic drive that we are in the end going to make consciousness, we're going to make persons and all this kind of thing. Well, and it's hype.
Well, the thing, it is hype, and it is, I mean, obviously the word artificial is related to the word artifice.
Ooh.
It is artifice. It is no different than when somebody pretends that a robot is a person.
Yes.
And they can make robots that look more like people and act more like people, but we know that they're not actually people. But there's some people, I think, who want to be fooled. They don't really...
I think that's absolutely right, because they find in some of these robotic companions that there's no pushback. They always agree with what they say, and a robot dog doesn't mess, and all this kind of thing. C.S. Lewis got it years ago when he says a carpenter makes a chair, it's an artifact, he begets a son. And that's the difference. And the drive. You see, for years, think about it, large scale, we've had a push from certain parts of the biological fraternity. Human beings are nothing but animals. Now we've got a great push. They're essentially nothing but machines that we can reconstruct. And you can see what that is an attack on the basic statement in the beginning of Genesis that human beings are uniquely dignified by being made in the image of God. That is under attack. And I believe that this is the important thing that I've spent most of my life defending in the public arena.
The idea that we're
made in the image of God.
Image of God.
Uniquely valuable, uniquely dignified. Now, AIs are made in our image, and therein lies a huge danger. Whose image? Ethically. That's a huge problem. Because countries don't agree, companies don't agree, because many AI systems inevitably have to be programmed with some kind of ethical dimension. A self-driving car driving around New York must know to avoid people standing in the middle of the roadway. So you've got to program it to make decisions. Does it knock over the man with the donkey cart, or does it plow into a line of children waiting for a bus? And all sorts of sophisticated developments of that.
So the question is, how can you even talk about ethics apart from God? What are ethics?
Oh, absolutely. And Dostoevsky said that long ago, and it's a hugely important question. If God does not exist, he wrote, or put into the mouth of Ivan and the brothers Karamazov, everything is permissible. He didn't mean atheists couldn't behave. He meant there's no rational justification for good and evil. And that's one of the huge problems in a multicultural, pluralistic world where we've lost what we once had in the West, a unified base for morality and ethics, as you know from your historical studies.
When you spoke a few minutes ago, you used the term superintelligence.
Yes.
Which I think you said is dangerous or potentially dangerous, because is it potentially dangerous in part because it can give the illusion of having personality and consciousness, that the many people all too willing to buy into that or to accept a superintelligence as a kind of God?
Well, there's that aspect to it. And we've reached the stage now where there are groups of AI worshippers, and it's becoming a religion, as it inevitably would. Because when you think about it, some of the properties that we regard essential to deity, omniscience, well, the internet, ask it any question, it behaves like an oracle, it can spew out scriptures ad nauseam, all the rest of it. Certain characteristics of AI systems are behaving like a deity. So people will start inevitably to worship it. And they have already started, because it's their go-to for answers to questions. Now, that leads us into a whole new area which hasn't been mentioned. And that is what we can roughly subsume as the large language models, the ChatGPTs, the Claudes, the Geminis, where more and more people are relying on artificial intelligence to consult about everything. And it's having huge effects on education, for instance.
Well, you talk in the book about how, and I've intuited this myself, I think we're not the only ones, but that
we're not.
There's something about the possibilities with artificial intelligence that are deeply frightening for a few reasons. And you, in the book, in this book, 2084 and the AI Revolution, you talk about that toward the end. So I wonder if you could say a little bit about that.
Are you meaning the kind of scenario that we get in the Book of Revelation?
Yes.
And its relationship to AI? Well, I think that's absolutely true. Because, and how I came about it and decided to write on it was reading one of the top American physicists, Max Tegmark, Princeton, I think. And he writes a book called Life 3.0. And he says there are various possible scenarios for development of a superintelligence that eventually takes over the world. It's this totalitarian world government scenario that you get in the famous dystopias like 1984 and Brave New World, books like that. And there are quite a few others like that. And very interestingly, in his book, he has several scenarios. Some of them, the AI is benevolent and loves human beings. In another, the AI is, to achieve its goals, it sees that human beings are just getting in the way, they're far too slow, and it eliminates the whole lot. And we all know these various things. But the one he chooses to spend most time is one called Prometheus, which is a world-based financial system, business system arising out of a clever use of Amazon, all the rest of it. And it ends up in control of the entire world. And as he goes along, he says that the control is maintained by forcing every world citizen to wear something with the functionality of an Apple Watch, but much more so, that can track people. Well, that's already happening with us sitting here. There's a tracker and there's a tracker. And listening to what they say, seeing where they go, knowing who they contact, all the rest of it. But in addition, the central government is reading all these automatically, of course. And if they disagree with this person's behavior, this thing emits a lethal injection and kills the person. And I thought that is very interesting. Wearing a bracelet, an identifier, the whole world and all this. And I immediately thought of Revelation 13, which describes what I call the monster who rules the whole world. Now, people push back immediately and say, oh, that's the Book of Revelation. It's full of imagery. Quite right. But Lewis taught me many years ago that imagery is always used to stand for reality. And Paul, in a crucial statement in 2 Thessalonians, clearing up people's confusion, they thought that Christ had already returned or something and the day of judgment had happened. And Paul, in straight language, no symbolism, says that that day will not come until the man of lawlessness is revealed. And he goes on to say that this man of lawlessness, and by the way, it's not civil lawlessness, it's spiritual lawlessness, as is explained by the fact that Paul goes on to say, who opposes everything that is called God and sits in the temple to be worshipped. And this person will be destroyed by the coming of Christ. That's plain language. Now, the Book of Revelation puts that into symbols and metaphors, but stand for a reality. And here it talks about an image being made to this monster. And this image is given breath, and it can execute anybody that does not fall down and worship the monster who rules the world. This is exactly Tegmark's scenario. And one of the reasons I wrote that book is very simple. If people are prepared to listen seriously to Max Tegmark's scenario, why wouldn't they listen to a scenario that comes 20 centuries earlier and has far more credibility than that? And they run almost exactly parallel. In other words, if you think about this kind of thing at all and set yourself up as a world dictator, how are you going to control the world? And it's obvious with modern technology how to do it. The number one thing is financial control. And we're getting closer and closer to it.
That's what's horrifying.
It is. It's happening in China.
Extraordinary is that we're at that moment. We've come to the place where we can see how this could happen.
Well, we're doing it.
Yeah.
And it's creeping into the West as well.
Yeah.
Social credit systems are the first thing. And in China, they're being rolled out, not very efficiently, but among the Uyghurs, it's the control is absolute.
Well, you and I know, since time is short, that what we're talking about is satanic. It's not simply unpleasant or something that we don't like. We're talking about something diabolical.
And we have to face that. I'm glad you said that, Eric, because it's quite obvious in Paul's straightforward prose text statement in 2 Thessalonians. He says that this individual is driven by the power of the devil. Now, in the book of Revelation, it's very interesting. Everybody virtually around the world knows the number 666, which is a number that appears in the book of Revelation. And everybody wants to know who it is.
It's Henry Kissinger. We figured it out.
I know, and I can give you another 100 names who it is. But nobody ever asks the question that's answered in the text, and that is, what is it? And the text says absolutely plainly, it is the number of a man, that is a human being. That's the hideous thing about it. This is a human being, says Revelation. It's not so important who it is. It'll be totally obvious who it is when it happens. But it's a human being driven by satanic power. We are in the region of the supernatural again. And the frightening thing, I think, about it all is that people who poo-poo a supernatural dimension, they reject God and they reject all of that, but they're allowing in the occult powers, and the devil is real. And again, I owe a lot to C.S. Lewis for rationalizing that and justifying it. But Scripture is absolutely clear. We're dealing with a supernatural phenomenon.
When Lewis's book, the final book of his so-called space trilogy, which is not a space trilogy, That Hideous Strength,
yes,
he writes about things that are very similar to what we're talking about.
Oh, he does indeed. I interact with Lewis's Hideous Strength in that book because I think he got it right. And thinking back all that way, 1940s, 1950s, and also his book, The Abolition of Man, in that Hideous Strength, he has these crazy scientists trying to resurrect a dead scientist and get rid, so to speak, of the body and preserve a mind and a brain. That's exactly what people are trying to do today. And Lewis made this very chilling statement that once we start messing about scientifically with the core of what it means to be human, we don't end up with humans, we end up with artifacts. And then he says the final triumph of this is the abolition of man. And that's a book I think almost everybody ought to read.
The Abolition of Man, no doubt. Now, I guess I'm suddenly wondering if artifact is related etymologically to artificial
and artifice. It is, of course. They mean the same thing. Ars, art, and facio, to make, in Latin. Okay. They're the same root, both words.
So to break that down, it's something that is made and that gives the false impression of being real.
Yes, well, what it does is it looks as if it's intelligent. And therefore, people say it's artificially intelligent, and they begin to suppress the artificial until they end up thinking that it really is intelligent. And that is a frightening side. But there's another side that I feel is hugely important for our younger generation, and that is interaction with AI is addictive. And there's a book, I'm sure you may have interviewed him, Jonathan Haidt.
Not yet.
On the anxious generation, yeah, which every parent ought to read. He's not a believer, but he's got the center of it.
Yeah.
The danger is, and we see it in education all the time, that young people are discovering they can write a perfect essay, just type in the prompts and it comes out.
Yeah.
And that's making them lazy. It's making them now wonder, what is the point in going to school? What is the point in being educated? And their reading level is down. I don't know whether you read the article not long ago in one of, was it The Atlantic, something like this, where someone asked a final year class graduating in a top American university. And he said to them, name the one book in the last 4 years that you've read that has really influenced you. There was dead silence until one student spoke up and said, that's not the way we do it these days. We read excerpts from books. We haven't even read one. Reading has dropped. Look at the statistics that have been published recently in the US and in the UK. And what concerns me massively about that is this. On the Christian level, our source of food is man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. As it affects our witness, we've only got one offensive weapon, the sword of the Spirit, the word of God. And this is such a subtle attack on the will to read.
Yeah.
That we need to develop a whole new set of arguments and thinking to show that young people that you can use AI to destroy yourself. And the addiction to it is as bad as the addiction to heroin. But you can use it to learn. In other words, instead of asking for it to create an essay for you and do your work for you, you can say, if you were going to approach this topic, what lines of research should I follow? And if you look at it that way, I did so the other day just to test this. I was thinking of writing something and it came back and it said, well, I think you need to follow this, this, and this. And by the way, you need to read the following five books. And I would begin to approach it along these lines. Don't expect me to do it for you. Mm. And that is a use that is perfectly justified. But we need educators now who know how to shift pupils from the lazy situation to saying, here's a tool, it's here to stay. How can we use it creatively? But it's going to be a huge battle. And on top of that, there's a smartphone addiction. I challenged about 500 American students just down the road 2 days ago. And I said, how many of you would be upset if your smartphone was stolen in Oxford? Every hand went up. I said, how worried are you about what your smartphone is stealing from you? There was dead silence. Stealing your time, stealing your energy, stealing your money, maybe, if you're into online gambling or all this kind of stuff. Stealing life from you. And it's a sentence of death, and we need to take it very seriously. So all of that's been driven by AI.
Well, the temptation, of course, what you just said about people not reading, it's interesting, isn't it? It's a regression. It's to go backward before Gutenberg. I mean, it's a fascinating thing that We have Gutenberg, we have the Reformation, which translates the Bible. You get people thinking for themselves, realizing we have an obligation ourselves to read the Bible and to understand the Bible and to understand everything ourselves, not to simply take, received wisdom from a sacerdotal elite. We ourselves have to get involved.
Exactly.
And we are now moving exactly backwards, so that it's just that it's a different priestly caste from which we're getting our information.
Well, it's like the Oracle at Delphi. The Oracle, you depend on it for everything. And it is very, very dangerous. The psychologists show us clearly that it is worse than heroin addiction. And so we're in a battle. And it's our responsibility, I think, to draw attention to these things. But we've got to do something about it. We've got to help our young people particularly not lose their lives over it.
Well, you mentioned Jonathan Haidt. It gives me hope that people like him are sounding the warnings over this, and that he's not a Christian.
That's right, but he's actually done something about it that's effective, because in this country, in Australia, and I don't know where else, they're now banning smartphones in schools. And parents are beginning to see and band together, take their kids out camping for a week, no smartphones. Yeah. And they're coming back within a week or two, having lost interest in the smartphones, having discovered friendship again, discussion again, fun again.
I remember fun.
Yeah, so do I. it's a wonderful thing to be able to remember, actually.
Well, I think it's the typical thing that you have to go too far before people begin to wake up. The question is, will enough people wake up? Will we take strong steps about it? To get back to AI in the few minutes we have left, where do you see it going? I have been myself startled by the speed of it. I mean, even 10 years ago, 5 years ago, it was nothing. Suddenly, you can do all kinds of things. It's astonishing to me. And obviously, it's moving forward so quickly that in 5 years, in 10 years, it's almost unimaginable where it will be. So what do you see happening, let's say, in the next 10 years?
Well, there are several convergent lines, but it's hard to predict, because another thing we haven't yet mentioned is the threat of joblessness, getting a job, because AI is going to take a lot of jobs. But when you talk to the experts, there's confusion there. Some of them say that 40% of white-collar jobs are going to go in the next 10 years. And then others say, no, we're creating more jobs. But that depends on retraining, reskilling people to use these things. And it's quite clear. My own son is raising the question. He said, well, I can see AI taking over my job. So one of the things we need to think about, and some people are usefully thinking about it, how can we help young people at the age 18, 19, and so on, to train for jobs that aren't in the risk area for being removed by AI? And there's some very good stuff being written about that and done about it. As somebody had said, it'll remove many lawyers, but not many plumbers. So there is work to be done. And the conversation is important. If I might just say a word as a father and a grandfather, with our children and grandchildren, we need to open them up to the conversation about the danger of their addiction and what it's doing to them, and get them talking about it just gently and not avoiding the conversation. Because here's the problem with AI. You can go into a room full of kids and there's no talking. It's dead silence. They're all looking at black screens, and it's robbing them of life. So we have a problem, but I think we have a resource to begin to think about doing something about it.
What do you mean, a resource?
Well, we've got a spiritual dimension, and we need to bring that right into the center and not be ashamed of opening the conversation at a Christian level, which is another reason I wrote the book, because I discovered a way that the AI nerds are willing to listen to. And it's been amazing to me how this has opened doors into very big AI concerns, secular concerns, because they find it a very interesting book, because nobody's actually talked to them about the Book of Revelation before. That's a big surprise.
It's almost funny that that AI has led us to a point where we can boldly, confidently, openly, straightforwardly talk about the Book of Revelation, about what you call the ultimate uploading, all of these things. We can suddenly talk about those things in a way, as you just said in the beginning of this conversation, where people would be, they'll be tuned into it in a way that they wouldn't have just a few years ago.
That's correct. Yes, absolutely.
Well, the book is 2084 and the AI Revolution, How Artificial Intelligence Informs Our Future. The author has been my guest, John Lennox. Thank you.
Thank you, too.
If you think these conversations are valuable, would you do us a favor and please like this video and subscribe to this channel? When you do that, you help us get these conversations out to a wider audience by telling YouTube that people are interested in this. Also, you can go to SocratesInTheCity.com, sign up for our newsletter, and you can check back every week. There's new stuff here every week. Thank you for tuning in.